nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Okay, let's go ahead and get started. All right, well, today what we're going to do is talk actually on three subjects related to safety. The first subject is with regard to the FDA, which is in America is our Food and Drug Association, and that agency is responsible for what we put into human beings, okay, consciously as a food or a drug. And I'll distinguish, I think with nano, we're going to start worrying about cosmetics, which is presently excluded from their purview. The EPA is the Environmental Protection Agency, and that's that I'm going to talk about with regard to all these nanomaterials and what we're doing to putting them into the environment. So that's to make you hopefully socially responsible citizens. And then lastly, the NIOSH is the American agency or part of the agency of that regarding occupational exposure to things. And so in that some of you are going to use nanomaterials in the laboratory, it's probably a good idea that you see how we are assessing what the possible risks are and how you should be handling or not handling nanomaterials. So with that, I'm going to go through this, and I'm going to try to, again, I've given you quite a bit of material. I've given you a lot of hyperlinks in the, both in the PowerPoint and in the references where you can go and look up a lot of original information. But that would be too much to go through and also a little on the boring side. So I want to show you where it is, and what I want to do is step back from it and tell you what's important, what to look for, and what is the essence of what they're trying to say. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and just start. And as I mentioned to you, and keep this in mind, this is meant to deal with how we protect our citizens no matter where we are. So there, I will make a few comments about the European regulatory agencies because I know a little bit about them and interact with people who have to live under their system. And the American one, which I'm a little bit more familiar with. These are, again, I'm not an expert in any of these areas, but I have spent a little bit of time, trying to at least become knowledgeable. And then I'll make allusions to other systems. But keep in mind that all of you, no matter where you are going to have these three types of agencies. This is both the United States and Europe have these agencies. And as I'll indicate, China has a very active FDA equivalent, and as many of you know, the Chinese people are starting to become very environmentally active, and the government is responding to those pressures. So I think you're going to see a lot more in terms of environmental regulations in China, and also worker safety. So as an example of that, I'll give you the hyperlink for that if you're interested. There is literally an SFDA in China, which is basically the state-sponsored FDA. And I've given you quite a lot of way to get into that and into the regulatory laws and regulations and how to see what the current state of the art is in China. As I said, this is a very very rapidly changing situation in China, and I think they are facing many of the same problems now that we have been dealing with in the United States and in Europe. So first of all, let's sort of give an overview. What does the FDA think about nanomedical systems? And it's kind of an interesting question because the FDA has been listening to a large group of people. I'm going to take you through the process. The first thing that they tried to do was to become more knowledgeable about nanomaterials and nanodrug delivery systems. And I think I think it's fair to say that when they first approached this, they felt very overwhelmed. because they just simply did not have the people trained. And if you think, just to put this in perspective, you are better trained than most people are in this area right now. There's a relatively very small number of people trained in nanotoxicology, and some of the problems of pharmacodynamics of nanoparticles. This is new territory. And so they quickly determined that they didn't have the knowledge that they needed. And they're used to small drugs, in terms of chemicals and, pretty well-known pharmacodynamics of those systems. But things change quite a bit. And I think they started from being totally overwhelmed to actually getting expert opinion. And then they've now seized in on several things. And I think some of those things you will recognize. So they started out with a task force. That's the usual thing that we do in the United States when we don't know what we're doing. We form a committee, and we study the problem. And we ask experts, you know, what their opinions are. And frequently, as you know, experts disagree with each other, which the general public doesn't understand that, because scientists are supposed to know the truth. And therefore, how can they possibly disagree with each other? And we know that truth is a provisional thing and something that's constantly changing in science. So what we believe now may change next year or the following year or even next week, based on new evidence, because we're always willing to challenge what we think we know. And the general public doesn't understand that. So there was a major report done, which took a fairly large effort of a lot of people. And I've given you the basically the URL for getting a PDF document copy. And it has some interesting things in it. What I'm going to do is abstract several things out of that and sort of summarize what it came up to. So they met, the scientists came to at least some consensus with some disagreements, I might add. And then presented this in a public meeting, which is the usual way we do things, to try to give people a chance to see where this material is coming from. Basically, they covered a number of things. One is nanoscale material products in the areas of food, including food additives and dietary supplements. And that gets very complicated, and we'll see in a few minutes why. Including color additives and things like that. Cosmetics were generally never considered by the FDA because they're things you put on the outside of your body. And the interesting thing that came out of this study was that the FDA realized that nanoparticles, if they're small enough, go right through the skin. If you put 10 nanometer wide diameter nanoparticles on the skin, they can not only go right through your skin and into your bloodstream, but in some cases across the blood-brain barrier. That's kind of scary, because we considered that things on the outside of the body and the skin would never penetrate. And that's just simply not true for small particles. And so, now the FDA is starting to, exercise some control over this. And this is in women's cosmetics, is a big thing. Whenever you make shiny surfaces, what you're basically doing is filling in the holes with nanoparticles. And so women's cosmetics are a big problem. And it's interesting that this is being revisited over 100 years later, because, in the early 1900s, women used to put radium in lipstick. Or manufacturers did. Okay? And this was the big rage, that women had lipstick with radium in it. Well, we know what happened with that. We had lip cancer, right? So now what we have is we have nanoparticles in lipsticks and cosmetics, which in some cases can be toxic and go right through the skin and into the bloodstream. So this is something that's changing a lot. There's nanomaterials going everywhere, and I'll point out a little bit later in the talk that I've actually got another on the Nano Hub, a lecture that I had a request to provide a lecture to people on nanotechnology in the environment and where we would experience it. And that might be something you might want to refer to at some point. I'll have a little bit of it coming out here today. But I spent about 40 hours going through preparing that 1 hour lecture and reading through the materials and abstracting, giving you a pretty good idea of where things were coming from. But when you start to appreciate the amount of nanomaterials all around you, and I do mean even in the clothes, some of the clothes that you wear have nanomaterials in them these days. So anyway, what I'm saying is what's happening right now is the FDA is broadening its scope to include not only things put actively into the body, but things that are put on the body. And I suspect what will happen soon is even the effects of nanomaterials in the clothes that you wear, since some of those actually come off and can go into the body. So there's a lot of new and emerging issues on nanomaterials, and we'll go through that again in that task report. And this is the basically the commissioner of the FDA accepting the report and realizing that there were going to have to be quite a lot of changes in the regulatory procedure, and in fact maybe even some totally new ways of thinking about this. When this was done, the purpose of this was to come up with things that the FDA had not been aware of before. And so as part of that, they quickly came up with things such as the dependence on size, that size matters a lot in terms of the regulatory. And we'll come back to that in a few minutes. But also that nanomaterials can behave very, very differently. In particular, they can be much more bioactive than normal chemical things because they have huge surface areas per weight or volume. So that's a characteristic. So they act much like an enzyme, even when they're in a non-enzymatic form, that can accelerate things. So let's talk about some of the findings of the report. We'll go into some of the initial recommendations, and then we start to see where the FDA started seeing that it had to worry about environmental aspects of this on nanoscale materials. And also, this is something that might be surprising to you, but the FDA is revisiting so-called GRAS products. GRAS products are generally recognized as safe. And if you think about it, human beings have been using products for a very long time, like thousands of years. And the FDA has been in existence for less than 100 years. And so what do you do with things where human beings have been putting things in their bodies? You can think about this with regard to herbal medicines, for example, and lots of home remedies and things that have been around for a very long time. Should it regulate those things? And I think when you start getting into this, if you think things that are manufactured, as we've been talking about, under tight controls are scary, think about the things that you buy in the store that you have no idea what's in those things. And they can be grown, they can be processed in various ways, and have totally different properties. And so I think it's, and people tend to believe that those things are safe because they say, well, people have been using them for thousands of years. And we can say, yes, people have been poisoning themselves and doing all kinds of damage to themselves for thousands of years. So it might be a good idea. That's why we have product labeling in the United States, to try to tell us when something's manufactured what ingredients are in it. But many things that are, quote, generally recognized as safe and are out in the marketplace have not been required to tell you what's in the ingredients. Okay, so it's these are issues that are a bit new. What we're talking about here, this report that they gave to the commissioner of the FDA, basically gave a brief synopsis of the state of the science for biological interactions. And I think the major things, messages were twofold. One was the size is critical and can change drastically what the interactions are in humans. And then because of the large surface areas and the so-called bioactivity of these things, nanomaterials can be much more potent than people would normally think of them as. So this is something that you know that because you've learned some of that in the course. So there were a lot of recommendations for science issues, and we're going to talk about that. There are different approaches. Every society has a different way of approaching safety. The Europeans by and large, like to know something safe before they start using it. Americans are brash. We tend to go out and start using things, and then when we start generating problems, we say, whoops, maybe we shouldn't have done that, and then we start cleaning up the problems and dealing with it after the fact. So those are very different approaches, and they frequently clash with each other. We think Americans think that the Europeans are too cautious. The Europeans think the Americans are too reckless. So, but these things are partly a function of the way our societies work on things. And then what we'll talk about here is just some of the recommendations for regulatory policy. And some of those are interesting because how do you, you know, if you wait until you know everything, then by the time you do that, and meanwhile you're sitting here manufacturing things and using things, it's pretty late in the game to be doing that. So the idea of actually making provisional regulatory things. So one of the things we'll talk about is realizing that you've got to make rules even before you have all of the answers. It's better to make up rules that seem to make sense and then to refine them as you go along. And that's something that I think, is a little new. The FDA, that's scary territory for the FDA. They like to know everything before they do anything, which is the frequent complaint. And here they realize that nanotechnology is moving so fast and things are being brought out so quickly that, and there's so few people that know how to study them, that they're always playing catch up, trying to figure out what's happening after it's already been happening. So this has been new territory for them for that reason. And so here's the challenge, is to try to figure out the safety issues as you're going along. And it's a very uncertain nature of the science, and potential for very rapid developments. As you know, technical fields have half-lives, we say, of information. And that is, the technical half-life is the amount of time that it takes for half of everything that you thought you knew about something to be proven wrong. Okay, now there are some fields where the technical half-life can be decades. And there are other fields, such as in bio-nanotechnology, where the technical half-life is probably closer to 3 to 4 years, meaning half of everything that you thought you knew 3 or 4 years ago has been proven wrong, and you've got to reevaluate it. And as I always say to students, if you think learning is hard, unlearning is a whole lot harder. People cling to what they learned initially, and then they need to adjust that. So what's happening with a lot of this is we're having to make rules as we go along. The FDA is very uncomfortable with that approach. But I think they have come to realize that that's the only possible approach, that they can't study these problems for 10 years and then make up some rules. They have to make some rules based on the information that they have now and then be willing to alter those rules. And I think that's a sensible strategy. And part of the issue is here whether we have all of the tools available. I've taught you a number of the nano tools and ways that we measure both nanoparticles and nanoparticle cell interactions. And do we really have sufficient capabilities? And what they have done is they have actually enlisted NIST, which is a federal agency in the U.S. dealing with standardization of things. And particularly NIST, it's a National Institute for Standards and Technology. And basically, they have been very much involved in characterizing nanomaterials. And we'll talk about that. There's actually a nanomaterial characterization laboratory, which is sponsored by NIST and the National Cancer Institute and FDA to actually, so people can send materials to them, and they have scientists who are pretty well trained and are trying to use the latest state of the art. But even that is changing. They know in many cases they don't have the nano tools that they need to do the job. We have a number of nano tools here, but even Purdue only has a sort of a partial subset. So we're always fighting that. And are they really sufficient to be able to do the characterizations? Again, if you can't measure it, you don't know what you're talking about. So the problem is coming up with adequate measurements. And again, that will probably change. And also what's happened very quickly then is that we saw that the FDA, in regulating materials going into the human body, had to meet with the Environmental Protection Agency, because we have two-way thing. We have in the manufacturing process, we're dumping nanomaterials in the environment, and also what's in the environment can inadvertently come back into and be ingested and get involved in humans. So it's not as neat a breakdown. Again, the example, a nice example being that we thought that the skin was an adequate barrier for many things, and now we know that's not true. And we also definitely already previously knew that things could be inhaled in the lungs. And that's a whole area of nanotoxicology which is quite different, because we thought we understood what happened to larger objects, but smaller nanomaterials that go into the lungs go in different places. So the pulmonary distributions of nanoparticles are not well known at this point. Okay, and then I've emphasized quite a bit of this in the course, understanding interactions of nanoscale materials with biological systems. This is something that really has to be studied at single cell level, and then up through tissues and organs. And the number of nanopathologists is very, very limited in terms of people who understand all the problems. So some of those, we have people in this room who are training in that area right now. So part of the problem is these nanoscale materials have very different properties that they can, they're on the same scale as, size scale in many cases, as proteins. So now you have not only protein-protein interactions, but nanomaterial-protein interactions, which can be, and again, thinking about this problem about surface area, in many cases, the nanomaterials can cause what look like almost enzymatic interactions with the proteins and change the functions of the proteins. So that's something that we're, and can make them much more biologically active than they were thought to be. So that changes. When they're more biologically active, then you have questions about dose and concentration that you really had not considered before. So these are issues coming out. So the adequacy of testing approaches and basically coming up with, so again, summarizing again, the disagreement of experts that pointed out that the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics of nanoscale materials are different, but nobody knows really what those are. There are very few papers. If you actually research the literature, you're going to find a very small number of papers, and they're very, at the very early stages of understanding that. And we know it's some of those reasons why. Because it's very hard to find the nanoparticles as they go distributing in the body and in tissues. We had some lectures on how you do that, what the problems are, and actually even finding where they go is hard. So we had some fluorescent approaches, we had some nanobarcoding approaches to try to be able to find those things. Toxicology tests are pretty short term, mainly because in general, most drugs break down in relatively short periods of time. In other words, the half-life of how long a drug is intact and active for small drugs and even most drugs that are currently used is a relatively short period of time. On the other hand, when those things are in nanomaterials, embedded in those, many of those nanomaterials may last for a very long time. Now, we have a limited amount of experience with that. Probably the best experiences we have with nanomaterials long-term is, and this comes from literally thousands of years, is the interaction of gold and silver. So we put gold in the human body for literally thousands of years. And so we have some idea that low doses of gold don't seem to have major long-term effects on the human body. But we don't have very many. That's a relatively a known one. Silver is a little bit different. Silver is more bioactive and has antimicrobial capabilities. And you find And you're finding now people are putting silver nanoparticles in clothing to prevent odors. I just bought a ski helmet for the upcoming ski season and found out that it had silver nanoparticles embedded in the inner structures of it to try to, when your head gets sweaty, to try to fight odors. A lot of nanomaterials that you find in your clothing. If you have clothing that is wrinkle resistant and water resistant, chances are it has nanoparticles in it. Okay. And those are sometimes advertised and usually not. Right now, people are a little afraid to advertise them. They take advantage of the nanomaterials, but they're afraid to tell you about it. Other things sometimes pretend to have nano things in them, but they really don't. So there's a lot of issues. And again, if you want to have a, if you want to have fun with that, go to the Nano Hub and look up the lecture on nanomaterials in your everyday environment, because you would be surprised. You go down your local shopping center to find all the things that are being thrown at you, including the clothing. Fabric is, textiles are a major use of nanoparticles right now. And, they last a little bit longer than, going into your washing machine, which then they can come off and then go down into the groundwater. So there's a lot of issues here. And they can obviously, come off and go onto your body. And then if they're small, they can go through your skin. Okay, so I mentioned to you a little bit about substances under the so-called GRAS, generally recognized as safe. These are things that have been used for a very long time. To give you a sort of an example of something, what we know about tobacco smoking right now, we would never, ever approve, the FDA would never approve tobacco and smoking. But tobacco and smoking have been around for thousands of years. All right. And so they are, I wouldn't say it's generally recognized as safe, but people have been doing it for so long that it's hard to ban it. Okay. So what we do is we try to say, well, you know, you've been using it for a long time, but it really isn't safe. And here's why. And we try to get people to stop using it and to produce some social pressures. And you've probably seen a lot of that. Those of you from other countries in particular, you're probably shocked when you came to America and saw all the no smoking on Purdue campus and similar type things, since a very high percentage of international students smoke. So we have not, the FDA has not been able to ban cigarette smoking, but we at least try to give people the safety problems recognized. Same thing with some of the alcohol, which in moderation may be a good thing, but alcohol poisoning is a serious problem, particularly among college students. Okay, and then in particular, products not subject to pre-market authorization. I mentioned the major new area that's going to happen is cosmetics, because they're typically very small nanoparticles, and they put them in also. The other thing is suntan lotions. A significant fraction of suntan lotions now contain nanoparticles. And depending on their size, rubbing that on the skin may not be a very good idea. Larger particles, when you get up to like 200 nanometer particles and larger, particularly for the guys who have car waxes that you put on your car to make it look extra special shiny, those particles are about 200 nanometers in diameter and typically don't go through the skin. So there's a lot of these things, but again, the FDA is in uncharted territory now, because the boundary between what you put into your body consciously and what comes into your body due to your environmental exposure has really changed. Okay, to be marketed, there's two requirements in the United States for having a new drug approved. So let's talk a little bit about this in terms of medical drugs. First of all, it has to be safe. And as applied, and that's very important, because when any medicine that you have, it'll tell you what dose is considered safe and so on. And you can obviously abuse that by taking higher doses. But it also has to be not only safe, but also effective. Now, the reason why the FDA came into existence is that until about 1910 in the United States, doctors in general were largely untrained. They typically were trained only as being apprentices to other people, and some of them were untrained at all, and they would dispense with all kinds of concoctions, making all kinds of wild claims. Most of them were things of home remedies and things, but making all kinds of wild claims. So the two things that we wanted to do was, first of all, make things safe. Even if it's not effective, if it's at least safe, then you say, well, people are wasting their time and their money, but they're at least not damaging. So safety is always first, because being effective is sometimes very hard to prove, because you're trying to say that it's that there's so many other factors that happen when you take a medicine or even a vitamin, for that matter. How do you know whether it's really effective? So the standards are quite different, and we're going to talk about that in regard to clinical trials, because the safety is always the first step. Proving the effectiveness is how we go down through a series of from phase one, phase two, and phase three clinical trials, by proving proving the safety, but starting to prove the effectiveness. So let's go a little bit further into that. So the general way that the FDA divides things is, say that we have either a drug or a device. And that has until recently worked very, very well. So we either have typically orthopedic type devices, for example, stents, basically things that are usually larger scale things that are put into the body are devices, and drugs were typically chemical drugs, and the distinction was pretty clear. The first place that this started to break down was when the orthopedic industry started making stents that were so-called drug-eluting. And the reason why they did that was to try to prevent ingrowth of cells or inflammatory responses to things. So they started having basically a drug emanating from the stent to try to prevent some of the bad side effects and other non-desired results. And so the drug-eluting stent was the first so-called combination product, where it was both a drug and a device. Now, what I would argue is that a lot of the nano drug delivery, nanomedical systems that you're designing for your class project, and that are already in the FDA approval pipeline, many of them are going to be seen as combination products, because the drug and the device are both so integrated. It's like a nanoscale stent, okay, where it's doing a function, is doing more than one function simultaneously. And the packaging of the drug itself is part of the device, because the packaging, as you know, may be the targeting process. It may be the packaging is part of the, for example, pegylation of a drug to prevent it from being taken out by the immune system and to improve the circulation time. So I think that the path is pretty clear, but there's also another interesting process there, that if you make a combination product, then you also are allowed to do something very interesting. And that is, we've talked throughout the semester about how many drugs are great drugs, but there's no delivery system. And the problem is that the drugs are going everywhere, and therefore they get pulled off the market in many cases because the doses are too high. And yet, putting them in as they normally do, with an exponential decay of those drugs and only a 1 or 2% drug delivery, the exposure is too high. So if those drugs, though, are safe in smaller quantities and you encapsulate them, then the possibility of getting a new patent, and this is something that, if you've already gone to all the trouble to prove that a drug basically at lower doses is perfectly safe, then putting that drug into a combination nano delivery system makes an enormous amount of sense, because you have billions of drugs worth of perfectly good drugs that are not able to be used on the market just straight as drugs. But if you put them into a nano delivery device, then you have a combination product. You can extend the patent period for up to 10 years, and which is a significant part when you think of all the work that you went in to prove the safety and efficacy of the drug in the first place. If you can get an extension of that and make effectively a new product, that should be a very compelling case. So I think what you're going to see is a lot of combination products using existing drugs. So you take a traditional conventional drug, put it into a nano delivery system, give it a smaller dose, and yet because of the combination device, you've got a new product, you've got a new patent, you've got a new territory that you can actually live within. Okay, so I think this is a paradigm, and this is something when I testified to the FDA, I was pushing that the one thing that we needed to do on that was recognize that in many cases the device could be a common device. In other words, we could make a vehicle, a nano delivery vehicle, where we just basically had it a way that it could take the drug as a cargo. So think of it as like a car, and that we could put the drug in the car, and if we approve the car, and all we change are the targeting molecules, then the targeting molecules we could think of as kind of like changing the windshield wipers on the car, so that we don't have to reapprove the whole car. If we know that the targeting molecules are safe, we know that the car is safe, then, and we know that the drug is safe, then we can start to make a pretty strong case that the combination is safe, and we can accelerate the testing. And besides, the FDA has an accelerated procedure for approval if you use very small doses of a drug. So it's only when you start to get above certain thresholds and start using large doses that things start to become a lot more dangerous. So the combination of those things can give you a very accelerated approval through the FDA. Smaller amounts of drugs, and also based on experience of what you've already used the drug for something else. So we've been talking a lot about theranostic devices, and this is again something very new for the FDA. They have some experience for MRI contrast agents that are being used in human beings, a large number of like iron oxide nanoparticles, for example. Are known as safe. So if we put those inside and that's a diagnostic device, then we can combine that for non-invasive imaging elements to go along with the drug targeting and make a combo device. So I think they're the different pieces. The general philosophy of all of this is if you have something that has multiple pieces in it, can you predict the behavior of the total on the basis of the behavior of each of the parts? Now, it's not an absolute given, because sometimes the combination can do funny things and you can get a different result than you would have expected. But it's rare, and particularly if all of the ingredients are fairly safe. So the definition of a combination product is that when you're actually combining some things, either biologicals, in the case of, for example, let's say we were to use the same antibodies in our combination device as are used for an anti-cancer monoclonal antibody. So the only thing that we're doing is, let's say we put that antibody onto a nanoparticle, we put a pegylated layer, polyethylene glycol, around it to increase its circulation time, decrease the amount that it's going to be eaten by your neutrophils, then we can say we've already tested the antibody, we know what it does, we're going to use it in lower dose. We already know what pegylation does in general, that's a safe process. And we can put that in a combined device, and we can do something that's already been approved, lower the dose, and we know what the behavior is pretty much going to be. And we can get a combination product, and we can use it at very low dose. So that would be an example. And that would be what I would say is that we really have nanomedical devices already out there. Yes.
So the pegylation coating would be considered as a device?
It would be considered part of the packaging of the drug.
Okay.
Now, right now, they're kind of loose on that right now, because they're obviously, we're pegylating chemicals. We're already doing the early stages of this. But I think as it becomes more evident, and particularly when we put the targeting molecules on, that's, I think, going to be the difference. We take a lot of drugs and we pegylate those to increase their circulation time, but they're still untargeted. But as we start to then say, okay, now let's put a targeting molecule on there also, then we've start having something which really is a device carrying a drug, and actually targeting it to something, which is a little different than just preserving the chemistry. But I agree that that's a sort of a fuzzy line between those things. So I think we're starting to deal with that already. Okay, and then CDER is the subset, is the part of the organization of the FDA which actually looks at this and does a lot of the testing. And so they've transferred some of the authority to the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, CDER. And they are the more forward, let's say forward-thinking part, testing of these new combination devices. They basically set up a new part of that. We also have a Center for Biologics Evaluation, which is was set up largely in response to the development of antibody treatments, for example, anti-cancer antibodies. Okay, let's look a little bit and go through, as we start to put these things in humans, we go through a series of steps. And I want to go very quickly through this, but I think every country is going to do it a little differently. But the first one is a so-called IND. If you're developing something new, the first thing you're going to do is request a investigational new drug application. And there are three different types. An investigator IND can be done by a physician treating a patient, and quite often what that's done is using a drug which has been proven safe but has not necessarily been proven effective. So in other words, there are always reports in the literature how a drug that was made to cure this disease seems to have some beneficial effects toward this other disease, but has not been firmly tested. But it's at least known to be safe. So it may or may not be effective, but it's at least known to be safe. And so the drug is unapproved in the sense of being applied to that second disease, but it's already been approved as safe, and a physician can prescribe that for their patients. And that has some interesting effects. It allows studies to go on a very limited basis. The physicians are supposed to take that information, the results of that, and send those results in. It allows you to see, because quite often drugs can have multiple uses that were not initially envisioned. Emergency use IND is one where if a doctor has a patient who's dying and all known things have been tried, and the physician thinks that something, a drug which has been proven at least reasonably safe, but maybe doesn't have time to be able to get FDA approval to that. For example, the patient is going to die within 3 months. They can take that drug and use it on that patient, in the absence of it being approved under emergency use, if there's no other alternatives. And some interesting things come out of these studies, both of the individual physician, IND and the emergency use, where frequently you'll discover a lot of things that you didn't know were going to happen. This is one where treatment IND is submitted for experimental drugs showing promise for serious or life-threatening. Again, it makes little sense to protect patients from dangerous side effects in drugs if the patient's going to die anyway. You might as well try something. The risk factor is different. We wouldn't do this to people who are healthy, but if somebody is dying and there's no hope for other things, then we expand a little bit what is allowed in terms of drug treatment. So that makes a lot of sense. The requirements for an IND application, first of all, that there have to be at least some preclinical data, typically on animals, for safe testing. And then we've talked about how we scale up from animal data. We try to get a prediction of what's going to happen with human data, and we come up with what's considered a probable safe dose. So you can do that under an IND. You can actually scale up the animal studies and go at least for very, very limited use, either for emergency or similar things for individual physician treatments and actually use that. They also, the IND requires some idea that, again, if you're going to base it on data that looks like it's reasonably safe, you better have some proof that you're manufacturing it at least in a similar way. Because otherwise, if you're manufacturing a way that comes out 10 times more potent dose per weight, then that kind of a variation, then you could get into some dangerous territory. So the manufacturing says that, yeah, I've tested on this and I can show that I can manufacture it to be reasonably predictable so that I can use that data and show that it's safe. And then lastly, initial clinical protocols and investigator information, that starts to be the things that you put into, you start going to a so-called institutional review board, an IRB application in the U.S., where you get permission to use it on patients. So this is the first step that anybody ever does when they invent something new, is to come up with an IND application. Something very similar to an IND is sometimes used interchangeably as a phase zero study. And basically this is a first in human trial system. And it's done with microdosing. In other words, putting the very small doses. Sometimes they will put in a very small amount and then gradually try slightly higher doses of that. But things that are far below what would be considered any kind of a dangerous dose. Designed to speed up and mainly what you're doing with that is gathering information on the pharmacokinetics. We need to know, does that substance accumulate in a particular tissue or organ? And that the only way you're going to find out is to do that. But microdosing is well below any perceived therapeutic dose. So that gives this is important, a phase zero study gives no data on safety or efficacy. It's just the first time putting it into humans in very tiny doses just to gather some very preliminary data. When you get into phase one, then phase one studies are testing in human subjects up typically a very small group on the order of 20 to 50 healthy volunteers. And the reason for this is that you want to know what the effect is if you give this out large scale. You're most likely to see what the effects are going to be on normal people if you start out with healthy people, because people who have a disease are not normal people and they may react quite differently. So what we do is test first clinical trials. Phase one is again getting into closer to therapeutic doses and determining much more into the pharmacokinetics and dynamics of that. Starting to get an idea of what the doses might be for therapeutic, and the tested range is usually a fraction of the dose that causes harm in animal testing. So again, we use those animals and then we scale back and we have formulas for different types of drugs based on what the toxic effects were in the animal, and then come up with this. And so phase one trials, again, are pretty much limited to healthy volunteers. When we get into, and then we get into a couple of different types of phase one. One is where you have a single ascending dose, so-called SAD assays, in which small groups of subjects are given a single dose, then observed, and if they're not, no bad effects, they're given ascending a little bit bigger dose, and so on, for a period of time. And if they don't give any adverse effects, then we've walked our way in with the patients, and we can see where you start to have side effects, and then that's considered the maximum tolerated dose. MAD, multiple ascending ones, are where you have multiple low doses, and then you do a little bit higher, I would say a more thorough study, various time points, and understand how they're processed. And so, and then here, food effects. This is something, because we've been talking throughout the semester mostly on intravenous treatment of drugs, but we know that most drugs that people take are taken orally. It makes a big difference whether the person has eaten or taken the drug on an empty stomach. And so any kind of oral studies are almost always taken with some food effects. And phase one starts to look at the food effects. And if you look at this, a lot of medicines will say take before, an hour before a meal, or don't take until an hour after a meal, because they've done these kinds of studies of food effects. And that can make a drastic effect. If you take a drug that should only be taken on a full stomach and you take it on an empty stomach, it could have maybe 10 times the potency, because it could go immediately through and not be mixed with the food and so on. So food effects are important. You need to pay attention to that. And those are usually part of phase one. Now, phase two clinical trials start to get serious about this. Performed in much larger groups. Remember, you're never going to see what the real true side effects are. It's like a Gaussian curve until you start getting out on the tails of the Gaussian. You start seeing who is your normal people. You start realizing that some people are less normal than others. Okay? And, so when you start getting, and most clinical, phase two clinical trials are well beyond 20, typically on the order of 100, 200, 300. Patients, and then you start getting an idea of what the variation from person to person is. And phase two clinical trials start to get a little more expensive, and you start phase two, so-called phase 2A, start getting the dosing requirement a little bit better, and then phase 2B is to study, this is, the dosing is, first of all, how much can be given safely. And then phase 2B is to start saying, how much do you need to be clinically effective? And people metabolize drugs very differently. So this can become quite a variation, which you won't see until you get enough patients to see the variation. Some people are very sensitive, and some people are not. Now, phase 3 clinical trials are when you start doing randomized controlled with very large numbers, typically in the thousands. And these get very, very expensive. And this is where we start talking about how it costs maybe in the U.S. $1 billion to develop a new drug that goes for wide scale use. And the reason for that is that by the time you get, let's say, 2 to 10,000 people that you've tested, drug companies will sometimes spend several thousand dollars per patient on these. I've seen figures up to maybe $5,000 a patient to recruit them for studies. In the U.S. So it gets very expensive. It's very expensive. It's time consuming. And typically, obviously they have to be very promising drugs at phase one or phase two, or they don't even try a phase three. Phase three, now you're starting to get really out on the tails of the Gaussian. This is about the time when you start running into people like me who have adverse drug reactions to a particular sports medicine. They never would have seen those typically in phase one or phase two, but now you start having 1% of people or 0.1% of people may get very violent reactions to a particular drug. You're only going to see them at phase three, and now you've put a lot of money in, and the typical response is, since we have no human genome screening for knowing who gets the drug, then if you get a serious reaction and all of a sudden 0.1% of people start getting really sick and perhaps even dying, then you pull the drug out of the study and now you've expended a good fraction of $1 billion out there and you have to pull the drug from testing and from market. So it's a serious thing when you get into phase three clinical trials. And this is the reason why that without, as I've made the case throughout the course, if we don't have nanodrug delivery and we don't use individual genome information, this is ultimately an unsustainable model. Okay, we've got to figure out, first of all, which patients should never get a drug. That will take care of part of the problem. And then we need to lower the dose and lower the side effects if we're going to have very large popular drugs in the future. Because we just cannot afford to do what we're doing right now. It's too expensive. So phase three trials are where things are really having problems right now. And quite often, the FDA will expect at least two successful phase three trials. So now, because they've had a lot of problems where one study where they may not have had enough statistically significant data. in most cases, the FDA will allow, by the time you're starting getting the data from phase 3 clinical trials, this is about the point where the pharmaceutical companies are starting to beg for mercy of the FDA and say, look, we've put $500 million into testing of this drug. So far, it looks pretty safe. Can we start having limited use of it? And so what they will do is they will start marketing quite often with recommendations, very strict recommendations and guidelines about dosing. They'll watch out for patients that they think are going to be more sensitive and limit it perhaps to a subset of the patients that are out there. But that allows, if you will, the clinical trials to go on instead of the pharmaceutical companies having to pay for it. You're now having the customers, the patients, paying for that by paying for the medicine, and also the health insurance companies are starting to pay for some of the phase 3 clinical trial data. Now, phase 4, that's not something you normally hear of, but this is something that is sometimes called post-marketing surveillance tool. After you're putting a drug out there, you still have to send in data to the FDA every time you get somebody has a severe side reaction or there's a bad event, and they collect that data. And in some cases, that will cause a drug to be pulled from market. That's really bad, because now you've given it out to millions of people and you're pulling it from the market, and there can be some really serious consequences. Okay, well, let's shift a little bit. I've gone through the phase of clinical trials. Let's shift over to the environmental aspects, particularly the Environmental Protection Agency. So assessing the impact of nanotechnologies. And I want to introduce a couple of things. And the first one that I want to do is the idea of life cycle assessment. And this is a kind of a new concept, and I think a good one. And that says is if you're going to create something, there's an expression in the U.S. that says if you break it, you own it. You know, if you go into a store and you tip something over and you break it, you bought it. Okay, well, this is equivalent to that in life cycle assessment, that when you create something, you've got to think about all of the consequences of that thing being in the environment until it's literally destroyed and no longer a factor. Its entire life cycle. And you're responsible for that. Now, that's come out very interestingly, because in the U.S. we've had very bad experiences of companies producing a product, manufacturing it, throwing the byproducts into the environment, and then going out of business and leaving the toxic cleanup to the citizens to pay, the taxpayers to pay. And leaving, we've had a number of very large, toxic, waste sites in America. Just really, really terrible stuff where nobody ever worried about it. And, I don't want to go into my philosophical, ideas about what I think the responsibilities of business are, but let's just say that businesses worry about their bottom line, but they don't worry about the total bottom line. The total bottom line is involved in this life cycle assessment, and they can't just take the part of the bottom line that they like, which is the part that generates the profits. We see that, you may not know this, but in the U.S., when you buy a computer in the U.S., there is a small built-in tax on that laptop or that computer system, because, believe it or not, computers contain lots of nasty toxic materials. And we have very limited here in the Lafayette area. We have an electronic waste place that will take some of those things and dispose of them, because otherwise, if you put them into the common dumps, they will leach chemicals and things down into the groundwater, and that can be really bad things. So that was the first example, really, major example in the United States of a life cycle assessment being put into saying the computer industry, if you make these semiconductor chips which have toxic things in them, then there has to be part of your responsibility has to be to pay for part of the responsible disposal of those things. So There is a precedent of that in the United States. I think a similar thing is starting to be, interestingly, I've been reading about it recently in China, where the Chinese government is starting to realize that they've had some very big toxic waste generation and thrown into the environment and starting to take life cycle assessment into that. Because otherwise, they're responsible for picking it up. It's nice to have business produce new products, but not if the government or the taxpayers have to pay for the cleanup. So as part of that life cycle assessment, and you can read the report if you click on this, it'll give you a lot of details on that. But if you start thinking about how much nanomaterials are going into the environment, it was estimated that about $30 billion worth of nanomaterials products are being generated in 2005. But by 2014, up to $2.6 trillion. I mean, this is an exponential growth of the industry using nanotechnology. As I said, the textile industry is one of the biggest all around the world. People are embedding nanoparticles in textiles. That's something that is huge. And then again, there's some serious questions about that going into the groundwater. So a lot of that, a lot of those issues. So it's growing very, very rapidly, and we have to worry about what the effects are and who's going to pay for the costs of those cleanups. And currently, very little is known. This is a, you know, we've been talking in a laboratory setting about toxicity, but you start putting those, and we talked about how in a laboratory setting, we have a closed environment. We can pretty much measure everything. The minute you have an open environment, out literally in the atmosphere, in the water, exposing to everybody, not just the laboratory workers, then you've got a potentially large toxicity problem. And nobody knows that. It's interesting that the Canadian government has already put into effect laws and regulations where anybody generating nanomaterials in Canada has to inform the government so they know what's being produced where. A similar law does not exist in the United States, nor do I know whether it exists in any other country. So the Canadians have been rather thinking about this. At least they know where the nanomaterials are being produced and where they're being disposed of. In the United States, we don't know that. And I don't know about that much in Europe either. So, again, I talked about the assessment procedure. Well, for environmental assessment, it's even worse because now even a person is a semi-closed system. We can examine the person. We can examine not only what's in the person, but what's excreted from the person. We've got at least a semi-closed environment. Out in the environment, things go everywhere. The river, lakes, oceans, everywhere. So how do we begin to do any kind of a life cycle assessment in toxicity? Well, the first rule of thumb, and this was, I think, important, do not wait to have near perfect data. Scientists always like to have better, we always want more data. But we've got to start to make some rules based on the best guesses that we can, based on the partial data that we have, and start to draw some conclusions and come up with some things. So there's a lot of issues here about life cycle assessment that are in this report, but I think the most important one is number one. Okay. Now, this is one that many of you are going to face, that I would predict that many people in this room are going to be working in environments with nanomaterials. Okay, whether you're in the pharmaceutical industry, whether you're in some other industry making things which use nanomaterials. So, in the United States, NIOSH, National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, is the formulating body that tries to make up safety rules. And so what they're trying to do is formulate things for workplace safety in regard to nanotechnology. Now, I can tell you that there are no real firm rules yet in the U.S. And we've actually had a few accidents here at Purdue where nanoparticles have gotten loose, and we weren't quite sure exactly how do we clean those up. We had a fire in a chemical hood that was producing nanoparticles. And some of those exposures, those things went up through the ventilation system. When workers spill things, we have a general rule of doing so-called double gloving. So you use gloves like you would for like a BSL-2, but you put another layer on so that if you puncture the first layer, that you've got at least a second layer. But again, recognizing that all surfaces are, as we know, a solid surface is really not solid. That's mostly empty space, right? If you get down to atomic level. So when you start getting very small things, then it's very difficult to say, how do you protect yourself from it? But double gloves, if it's in a powdered form, you have to have a respirator. And we're just starting to get into this, these issues, where most people are still just using passive masks, but those are probably not good enough if the particles are very small. But again, there's very little data on that. So we're trying to say, you know, what do we do to protect? We do know that we've had a lot of experience, bad experiences with asbestos, for example, getting into people's lungs and causing a variety of diseases. And so this data is still being gathered, and there are no firm rules. I sit on a number of safety committees, including for the Burke Nanotechnology Center, and we're trying to come up with, again, not perfect data, but the best knowledge that we have to try to make it a safe place to work. But these issues are still being resolved. And again, some progress, some basics have been done with this, but again, depending on the size and the shape. So people, for example, are worried about carbon nanotubes because they can have some of the properties, the physical properties similar to asbestos, but they're made out of different material. So we don't really have good experience with that. And as part of that, we need to try to determine if nanomaterials pose risks. I think what you're going to see is some of them may be risk for toxicity in specific cases. One of the things, there are many chemicals for which if a woman is pregnant, that we don't want, the risk factor is different for that pregnant woman and her child, because now we know that many things cross the placenta. We used to think differently about that. So there are, in fact, many already for chemicals and types of things in the environment, safety rules that pertain to women who are pregnant. I think we're going to see similar things with nanoparticles, because the developing fetus could be very sensitive to some nanomaterials that we would never see in an adult human. A variety. We know that individuals are differentially sensitive or susceptible to environments. That creates a whole bunch of issues because we want to be fair to people, but some people, particularly, for example, if they have lung problems, we don't want them to be around certain chemicals, and we probably wouldn't want them to be around nanoparticles that are in powder form. So there's a lot of issues here. Again, a lot of this, as we have worldwide markets, what we do in one country really does affect what happens in another country. And I think nanomaterials, that's going to be particularly true. So promoting the workplaces and the products that we make is going to be very important. So there's a lot of hazard assessment. I think with all things, we have to assess the risks. Americans are notoriously very bad at assessing risks. There's a risk to getting out of bed in the morning, but there's also a risk to staying in bed, okay? So you have to be realistic about these things and come up with something and decide. For example, many Americans are afraid of flying, okay? Well, it's far more dangerous driving to work in the average automobile than in a typical plane flight. People don't have good sense of risk. What we want to do is come up with, we can't stop, it would probably be unwise to stop all uses of nanotechnology until we can assess all these things, and there may be risk factors, but we already have been living. You realize in the United States we dump roughly 5,000 new chemicals into the environment each year, and we don't even test them. We have no idea what those things do. So to say that, you know, that nanomaterials, we tend to fear what we understand the least. And so I'm very afraid of some of those chemicals, which I know are, we had things like dioxin that was released in the toxic waste dump in Buffalo and then went all through the Great Lakes. I used to study dioxin as a chemical. That's a terrifying substance. It will destroy the immune system, very small amounts of it. And it was put into the water systems. So we got to the point where, the amount of dioxin in Lake Ontario was sufficient that the advice was, yes, you can fish in Lake Ontario, but don't eat more than two of them per year. What does that tell you? I wouldn't eat any fish in Lake Ontario based on something like that. So there's a lot of things. You got to figure out safe levels, and that's a chemical, not a nanomaterial. So, there's a lot of things. We've had some experience. We need to do accurate risk assessment. We have to figure out what the exposure is. Can we limit exposure? That's typically what we do in the workplace. We've been doing this in the semiconductor industry. I mentioned that there are nasty things. There's a reason why people are suited up. It's not only to keep them clean, keep the work area clean and the substances clean, but also to protect the workers in some cases from the substances that they're actually using in manufacturing. So there's a two-way process there. So we need to be able to evaluate the risk, and we have to have some way of measuring it to know what the exposure is. We have a lot of experience measuring radioactivity. People who work with that wear badges so they know what their exposure level is. But chemicals are much harder. We don't have very good biosensing mechanisms right now. That's a very active and important area, building biosensors to determine chemical exposure and nanoparticle exposure. So all of this is part of the process of hazard identification, exposure assessment, try to determine a risk, and then manage. This is the critical thing, managing the risk. You can't avoid it. You've got to actually do that. Now, one last thing, just to give you an idea of the, I mentioned about cosmetics and everyday products in healthcare. The amount of products going in there is going up exponentially, we've already passed well beyond this $6.5 billion that was listed in 2009. And so this is growing so fast, and relatively few. There's been some delays, but not very many. So mainly a lot of these products that are out in common everyday use that you literally are being exposed to every day are not even, that exposure is not being limited in any way. So again, you can read these. It's good to know where these things exist. Again, I don't expect you to know the details. I just expect you to know that there are three areas that we want to do. We want to look at the safety of putting nanomaterials and drugs into the human body. Okay, we have to have some agency to do that. The FDA is what we do in America. We have to think about what happens when you manufacture anything, there are byproducts which go in the environment. So we have to have something studying the environmental aspects. And then lastly, these things that are being produced are manufactured by workers who by definition are going to be in a position to get extremely high doses of this if they're not wearing protective gear. And as you know, the first thing that we do with BSL-2, for example, is you have individual protective gear. And so that's the first line of defense here is to, again, double gloves, masks as appropriate, and eye protection, things like this where nanoparticles, anything that's a mucous membrane through your nose, through your eyes, and mouth, those are very active ingestion points. So you want to protect against those things. So try to give you a quick overview of all of that and happy to answer any other questions you might have. Yeah.
So I like two things. So like you were talking about the regulation of, products which have been available for a long time or which have been used for a long time.
Yes.
And there are several issues in this is that they have been in use and so how can we regulate them? Also considering the fact that there are the society is so multi, people, there is too much cross-cultural exchanges these days. So in any community, how can you regulate this? Will there be genetic specific reactions? So how will you...
Okay. So if I summarize the question, it's really around the so-called GRAS, the generally recognized as safe or things that have been out for a long time. And what you're alluding to is how do we regulate that, and the fact that different societies use things in very different ways, and there are cultural differences. Well, I think I gave one example of that, and I think and it's one that I travel around a lot around different parts of the world, and I see hugely different attitudes, and that is tobacco smoking. 40 years ago in the United States, roughly half of all adults smoked. And now that has gone from 50% to roughly 20% in the United States. And it's also shifted, interestingly, that there are more women than men smoking in the United States, because women smoke to use it as a weight reduction device. Seems to me a high price to pay for losing a little weight. But what we find is a lot of, and then if you go to Europe, you'll find still roughly 40% of Europeans. But that is starting to change. It's starting to really drop in Europe. I'm amazed when I go to China or India or Korea. It's probably much higher than 50%. And virtually every Korean I know, smokes. But interestingly enough, in the five years I've been traveling to Korea, half of those colleagues that smoked have stopped smoking. They were initially in shock when they came to the United States and found they couldn't find any place to smoke on the Purdue campus. But then they started realizing that maybe that was a good idea. And if you make something in the U.S., could we regulate it? No. The FDA does not have purview about tobacco smoking in the U.S. What we have done is allowed them to put warnings, and we've educated, and we've made it more, it's much more effective for things like that to come up with social disapproval. So in the U.S., it's been more like, do you realize how bad your teeth look? Do you realize how bad your breath smells and your clothes smell? And hotels say, I don't want you smoking. There's a $200 a day fine if you smoke in that room, because we have to clean it up for the next customer. So there's a lot of things to regulate behavior, and people start to get the message, and they start to, if they have to smoke outside, particularly in the middle of winter, that's a strong deterrent. You see the people in the U.S. smoking outside the buildings, and they're shaking, and everybody looks at them and kind of, you know, the holier-than-thou-art attitudes of the people who don't smoke say, oh, those poor, pathetic, drug-addicted people. And pretty soon, you know, it gets less attractive having to smoke out when it's 20 degrees outside. So that's about all you can do. And the same thing with trying to teach people to drink responsibly as opposed to drinking themselves to alcoholic poisoning and or doing reckless behaviors and things. But there's also a lot of interesting social things, because if you look at that, we tried to prohibit alcohol in the United States back in the 30s, 1930s. And what that did was that by trying to prohibit something that everybody did, we made it a criminal offense, we made it profitable for the criminals, and we ended up with a huge crime wave. And then a few years after that, we decided to reverse the law. Yet, unfortunately, we didn't learn much from that, and so now we have the war on drugs in the United States, which makes it a very profitable activity for criminals. So we don't seem to learn this very well. Needless to say, my strong predilection is to treat use of things and abuse of things as a social problem, a social and a medical problem, and to try to keep it out of the criminal and the legal part. And I think that's where it's most effective. And we have some pretty good examples of that. For example, the Dutch do not have a criminalization of use of drugs. That doesn't mean that they like that or that they condone that, but they've taken a lot of the crime and the profit out of that. And so many people think the Dutch are very liberal people, and that they must have lots of drug addicted people, and actually their percentage of drug addicted people is actually lower than most of the rest of Europe, because they treat it as a medical social problem. So these are a few of my philosophical pontifications, but it is very hard to remove things. We also know that there's many things that are home remedies and things which are probably useless. They really are more a placebo effect in the person, where they think that those things are being effective. But as long as they're not harmful, we say, all right, they want to waste their money on those. To give you an idea how massive that is of people taking what we call over-the-counter drugs versus prescription drugs in the United States, half of all drugs used in the United States, legal drugs in the United States, are over-the-counter, non-prescription, generally or generally recognized as safe home remedies. So Americans spend as much as they do on that as they do on all prescription drugs, which is huge if you think about that. So it's a complex problem. How do you get people to do things which are in their best interests?
I mean, this, the last idea could also be a fallout of the medical costs.
Very interesting. Purdue's insurance rates are going up next year. Anybody who is a smoker will pay a surcharge, additional surcharge of $250 per year. Why is that? Because smokers generally have more health problems, and the rest of us subsidize those. So the idea of so-called victimless use, oh, whatever I do is just harming me, it doesn't hurt anybody else, that attitude has really changed in the United States, because we recognize that if somebody's an alcoholic, their family suffers, society ends up having to deal with a lot of issues. Tobacco smoking is a hugely expensive thing, and we all have to pay for the costs of the smoker. The smokers, we subsidize the health insurance of the... So this idea that what you do by yourself it has no effect on anybody else, that's really a pretty naive point of view. And what other people do does affect us. So that's becoming, you know, at some point there are boundaries on that, but I think that has become very commonly. And as I said, Purdue's insurance policy starting next year actually starts penalizing tobacco smokers. Yeah.
I know you've brought this up a lot about the genetic, I guess, about looking at the genome and drug interactions. Now, the thing is, have a lot of these interactions, and based on your genetics, have they been identified? There are numerous drugs, but do we actually know, what percentage, I guess, would we know that we could identify based on the genome versus...
Okay, so her question is, I've said a lot about the use of individual human genome sequencing to give an idea of, first of all, which patients should never have a drug, and number two, which patients might respond positively to a drug, so that you pick the right drug the first time, because sometimes you've changed the patient. So her question is, how many drugs do we know in terms of the genome that we could actually use that information right now? And the answer is probably less than 1% as a realistic figure. But there is a fairly massive effort going on to produce. We already have on the order probably of 1,000 individuals or more who have had their genome sequenced. That's still a very small number. Think about the thousands that we do in one clinical trial. So it's going to take, and I know that there are estimates that before they really will start to even see many of those interactions, they probably will need at least 10 to 20,000 people whose genomes are sequenced. We've got to bring the cost down, because right now that's still at costs on the order of maybe of $10,000 to $20,000 per. Some of that's being subsidized. To do that, to get that information. But we will never get anything useful out of our human genome sequencing until we do those kinds of studies. That was the original hope. But as I told you, the original, when we said we had completed the human genome sequencing in 1999, no human being on this planet had yet been sequenced. That was a collection of pieces of DNA. As of, it was only been about 4 years ago that the first individual human beings were sequenced. And so now that's going on at a very rapid rate. What's going to happen before the human genome sequencing, because of the price of that, is you're going to have, I mentioned about so-called SNP chips, the single nucleotide polymorphisms, where you have one base pair in a particularly susceptible part of the genome. there are a number of things being tested for with SNP chips, because then it takes a drop of blood. They've made very, very cheap, very fast sequencing for those ones where they know are particularly vulnerable. So the SNP chips are going to come first, and I predict that most of the information will come from that first. It'll probably be at least 5 more years before we've gathered enough data to really start seeing the benefits of individual human genome sequencing. No, very, very valid point. But on the other hand, without that, we have this perpetual problem that we will never know. As we put, every time somebody puts a drug into it, the next person, you may kill the person. You simply have no idea. So I don't think we can continue along that path. So we'll start by a limited thing with SNP chips. We'll get the sequencing cost down. We'll get a little better idea of at least the more people who are more likely to be vulnerable. I think we'll start seeing some positive effects from that. It's very hard until you do enough of, you know, because we have this battle about, okay, so, how can we say the human genome sequencing is going to help? Well, we haven't done enough of it to be able to make that assessment. But from a scientific point of view, we can say that it certainly should help. And it should be a way to counter this very large problem that we have.